And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and my guest today is Odie Lindsay. Odie's writing has appeared in numerous outlets, including Iowa Review and Best American Short Stories. 2016 sees the publication of his debut, a short story collection called We Come to Our Senses, available from W.W. Norton, and it has already received starred reviews from Kirkus and Booklist. The stories in We Come to Our Senses have a bit of something in common. Either the protagonists have served or will serve in the military, or someone who served affected their life in a significant way. Has that always been a theme in your writing, or?
Funny enough, it wasn't. For the first 12 years, I guess, after my own deployment, which was Operation Desert Storm in 1991, I barely spoke about it, let alone wrote about it at all. I'd meet friends, and several years later, something would come up that I'd been in the military. It was really only 2003, once the sort of drumbeat to the new series of wars in Iraq started up, that it really sort of came at me like a truck. I'd been writing, I'd written a couple of stories in a novel here or there that it was seemed unfocused. All of a sudden, watching a new generation of troop deploy to the same place I had been at 19. There was a president had the same last name. Saddam Hussein was the same sort of guy. It was a really intense sort of experience. That's when I started to see, wait a second, I need to revisit this. Even some of the sketches I'd had along already were leaning that direction. So that's really when it came together.
And you have a story in the collection, Colleen, which points out that has a mother and daughter duo who have served in each war.
Absolutely. That was another thing. That same time frame when I started thinking about my experience, some of my colleagues' experience in terms of the traditional sort of war narrative, a lot of boots on the ground stuff and horrific things, that wasn't really my story to tell. And yet my colleagues and I still mulled over. Something happened there. This experience changed us. So what I started to do was try to think, well, what was it about my experience or perhaps even about the larger war narrative that's not necessarily there? And one thing that came to mind, I thought, gosh, there's this dearth of narratives of female troops, even though there are so many female troops. In fact, one of the first people taken as a POW in 2003 was a woman named Shoshana Johnson, African-American female. She was shot several times. Her picture came on television. And I thought, wow, not only do we not include these soldiers in narratives, but often we don't even bestow them sort of a combat designation, yet here's someone who's been shot, who's been taken captive. So I thought, I want to explore that as mindfully as I can, maybe some stories of troops who aren't as pronounced or who are active but maybe not come to mind initially when we think of the quote-unquote sort of war story or war narrative, yeah.
And you do write across gender as several female characters, and a woman's experience is going to be much different from a man's experience in the military. So did you do a lot of interviews to gain insight into what their experience was?
You know, I did some interaction with female troops, certainly when I was in the service, things that I saw. I did quite a bit of reading. I also, from a scholarly perspective, looked at some books. Kenneth McLeish has a book called Making War at Fort Hood that sort of, he's an anthropologist and he studies the body at war, for instance, and these types of titles to help me think about differences between soldiers. I tried to read as much as I could out there about that experience. And at some point, I also realized that I need to be as mindful as I possibly can, but that this is also going to be fiction. And I think it would be problematic to try and be overly specific because there's such a dynamic range of experiences there. So I just had to trust that if I wrote straight into the truth as best I could, as mindfully as I could, and I'd studied to sort of complement that, that hopefully I would do a decent job kind of representing that dynamic.
And it seems it's going to be very difficult because, especially in the enlisted ranks, you've got a lot of 19, 20-year-old young people there. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of hormones going on, and so sex and sexual assault are going to be major themes in these stories.
Yeah, I think that unfortunately, that's such a large part of the experience. It's such a problematic component of not just hormones, really, but if you think about it, you know, when you're deployed in general, we sort of expect and or we anticipate that certain lapses in judgment will take place, or that people are sort of able somewhat to say, you know what, back home, I would never think of shooting at someone. However, in this situation, I am going to think of shooting at someone. Well, this is not to say in any way that the majority of troops have this, but if you are suspending some sort of dynamic range of your moral or ethical behavior. A. B, you're under assault. C, you're out of sort of your normal day-to-day element. And D, you're scared. I think sometimes this results in some really erratic, unfortunate behavior, coupled with perhaps the hormones. I mean, you do have young folks, but it's a problematic dynamic. I wanted to focus on that. That seemed to be such a recurrent component when you do read about female troops' experience, when you do read about even in the application of how sometimes the armed forces treats the body. For instance, we know that sexual assault can often happen in terms of friendly fire, troop on fellow troop activity at night if a female were to go outside and go to the latrine. At night, if she gets out of a vehicle to go into the darkness by herself. Well, that's an area that I think it's ripe for us to take in. It's not anti-troop. It's not anything like that, but it's problematic. It's about a different application of what we expect between different bodies, even in a very practical sense. There are ways to attend to these situations that we almost, if it's a female, we haven't necessarily bestowed upon them the same resources as we would to male troops. So yeah, that is an area. It's not one that it's often we want to face, but I think it's so vital to kind of include that as part of the narrative.
Well, and especially in contemporary circumstances where you have people, as you said, suspending kind of their normal moral operations, and they get over there and traditional outlets aren't available to them. Alcohol, not mm-hmm. in the kingdom, or, you know, you have to have Pruno or something mm-hmm. like that going on. So the traditional outlets for letting off steam, this stress that comes from being under attack, the threat of mortality, leads people to act out.
Mm-hmm. And that may be the case, absolutely. I mean, you're talking about a tremendous amount of information to process in terms of why you're there, what may or may not happen to you. When you're looking at the sky and you see a weapon streak over your head, processing that is really difficult. Processing that at remove, and what I mean by that is to try and check your emotions so that you can sit there and say, okay, that's supposed to happen. Here's what this means. Here's my job. I think it can be problematic. I think you can lose your bearing on what's applicable to a situation and or your own well-being. I mean, again, I don't want to speak for sort of a larger contingent. That's sort of my personal inference in a space I wanted to explore with the stories. But yeah, it's a lot to ask somebody to process, both during deployment and even when coming home and saying, okay, now that's done. Come back just as you were.
And be a human.
And be a human again. And so both sides of that were things I really wanted to sort of explore in the stories.
Now, what was your experience like in the military?
My experience was, my deployment was the better part of a year. Situated on the Iraqi-Saudi Arabian border, our job was to sort of go in and with the initial ground deployment, with the ground war assault, we're supposed to go to Baghdad and got about, I think, halfway there. And they said, okay, go back. Day to day, it was seeing airstrikes, seeing jets, seeing a missile or two, hearing about a Republican Guard unit, let's say, who had mobilized within a couple of miles. It was a lot of war at a distance, a lot of just sitting with this vague sort of ominous threat that fortunately, in that scheme of sort of very visceral bodily trauma, didn't materialize. I'm grateful for that, but that also was sort of a thrust of the book, is when I do have colleagues or I do speak to younger folks who deployed here, and yet perhaps they never saw immediate fire and or, you know, consequence, but they still, something happened to them that they feel displaced or they feel a schism in terms of their psychological well-being. And so that really was part of that and a challenge. How do you write about war without combat per se? What do you do?
And I have read some studies that said that PTSD affects some in the military more expressly when they weren't in active combat, mm-hmm. that people, when they had a sense of agency in combat, they knew they could control their fate to some extent, fared better than people who were behind lines but subject to IEDs and things like that.
I think that that makes sense. I think we all, you know, the narrative certainly as you're sort of growing up is that you do exhibit the sense of agency or you can have some impact, and the next thing you know, you're sitting in this space processing information. You realize that you may or may not have any control. You realize that you're just sort of sitting in a suspended state of anxiety for a prolonged period of time. Yeah, processing that as a normal day-to-day experience and then again coming back and sort of expecting to plug right back in is difficult. You also, I think, you're so ready to execute and or execute a task well, and or when you come home, sometimes you lose your bearings as to how exactly tensed up and or focused to be on certain tasks. And I'll give you an example. I was teaching a few years ago in Austin, Texas. I taught a veterans-only section of English composition. It was fantastic, and I had these really great students, and they're really bold students writing-wise. But one of my students was my age. He had been both in Desert Storm, and he had deployed multiple times to Iraq, Afghanistan. He was a Marine sniper. And I'm asking him to format a paper one day on Microsoft Word, and we use the MLA format. I don't know if folks are familiar, but it's a very particular sort of style. That, you know, your margins this.
It's not AP, it's not Chicago.
It's not AP, it's not Chicago, it's double space this. Here's how you cite your sources. In the scheme of things, maybe we could argue it's important or not important. It was just about following a procedure. Well, I went and talked to him one day, and he's just, I could just see the anxiety on his face. And I said, what's wrong, man? He said, you know, I've deployed, I think it was 5 times over the last 20 years. He said, I can sit on a rock for 18 hours and be as chill as if I was doing meditation. I said, but this MLA stuff is making me crazy. He was laughing about it and not. He couldn't process, he couldn't complete the task properly, and it was just thwarting him, and it was thwarting the big picture. And I said, you know, it's okay, but I think there's that also, even those little things, how to run a copy machine. I had that in one of these stories, a copy machine breaking somebody down. The weird nebulous space of either needing to have too much control or needing to cede control that just gets off a little bit sometimes, just gets off a little bit.
As you say, most of the stories in the book are about redeployment back home, trying to integrate back into civilian life. We have a couple of people who are getting ready to go into basic training. And then the very last story in the collection is actually in theater.
Right. The last story and sort of retroactively speaks to some of the themes and some of even the characters appear in that last story that are sprinkled throughout. That, again, was a challenge for me. I wanted to look at different troops in terms of females. There's a lesbian troop in here. I wanted to consider stories that weren't as active, maybe haven't yet received as much of the narrative as they deserve, I think. But also the day-to-day exploration, whether it's the child of a veteran, it's somebody thinking about signing up. I just thought watching those troops go in 2003, and again, just not trying to politicize it, but just sitting there and thinking, wow, here goes another generation. I'm 12 years removed from this. My colleagues and I have some pretty intense feelings related to our experience. Look how long it lasts, even when you're not directly, arguably submitted to some of the truly horrific components of war. And I thought, I want to bring that home. I want to explore what it's like for some people here. What is it like when the copy machine breaks down? What is it like when you're a young man and you're feeling sort of culturally impotent or stymied? You know, what narrative do you turn to try and address that? What is it like to be the child of a veteran who raised you with sort of a dysfunctional element? Doesn't always make for positive cocktail talk, but, you know, memory doesn't stop. Trauma doesn't stop when you jump off a plane on a tarmac at Fort Bragg, right? The sort of, or when you're in a car wreck. We can all think of good times or sort of terrifying times, and they can come right back to us immediately. So I thought it's just ridiculous that we sometimes forget that redeployed troops, it doesn't go away. So I was interested, how does it play out often at home?
Well, you talk about repeating characters, and there's a trio of stories that have the same couple, an unnamed narrator and his wife, Darla.
Yeah.
And the military connection there is that she, long in her past, had essentially a one-night stand with a man in the military, and she's, I'm guessing, HIV or some other autoimmune complications come about.
Absolutely. Again, I was just like, how thin and yet potent of a thread can I explore here? What's the fallout? And, you know, we look at a region like the South, in particular, sort of this particular militaristic history, but also a very practical application of bases, of economy, of culture, of this sort of ripple effect of entanglements that we have, good, bad, and other. And I thought that's one that I could look at. how would it affect even this person if a previous partner with his, the person he loves, had infected her? And it is HIV. I didn't want to sort of broadcast that. It's not as explicit in the story. It's fairly,
but you see when they go to the pharmacy to get the drugs to
right.
control
yeah.
it.
I mean, it's fairly spelled out with exception of those three letters. But what I realized is that sometimes when you put a term like that out immediately, folks forget to look at the day-to-day sort of disruption or the day-to-day navigations. And it seemed to me that, along with the day-to-day of being home or the day-to-day ripple effect, I wanted to have the day-to-day of living with sort of a chronic illness. Because as many of us know, there's a big neon sign that might say HIV or cancer or something else. But really, it's that day-to-day that can be a grind, or just an exploration. So, yeah.
And you see, they have a very complicated relationship. They've moved back to Mississippi, where she's from, I guess, Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not ready for the transition. And at the moment, he's kind of coasting on this good guy status, that he's the man who married the sick girl.
Right.
So he should be cut a lot of slack.
Yeah.
And in each of the story, there's a strong animal component, too. And you can kind of see in the first story, which is titled Darla, he's rescuing snapping turtles who are stranded on the highways.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one, there's a bird on the back.
On her back, yeah.
And there's a violent confrontation with a bird. And then finally the dog in the final story, which is the title story of the collection, you can see the arc of their relationship through the health of those animals.
Right. That's funny. Certainly those were sort of symbolic vehicles for me, but also living in Mississippi, there are a lot of turtles on the road. Unfortunately, there are a lot of dogs running around the road, many of them meeting their doom. So it was both practical. I was writing from the space, but I was also, trying to think of the impact and think of when you're in this tussle with very real thinking, complex people who can't see in each other's thought process and who may navigate each other differently. Animals, better or worse, they often provide this. They just provide an extra dimension, maybe of fairness, maybe of unfairness.
Because you also have the cats in the alley.
I have the cats
in the alley.
And then
the camel in hers, the combat story.
Yep. There's a dog in Evie, the opening story. I don't know. And I adore animals. I just love animals. I always have. But it's funny because they sometimes become the vehicle again of brief amounts of love or vehicles that bring home this sort of unjustness of a basic situation. Or in the case of the bird was terrorizing this man. He was terrorized by a one-eyed bird. But that's just something. Like I say, I revere him. I always have. But not treating him so nice. I needed to write a nicer book about
animals. Well, you didn't treat anybody nicely.
I didn't treat anybody nicely.
The human animal didn't come across very well either.
It didn't. I know. I worked with Tim O'Brien last year at the Sewanee Writers Conference. He was reading some of my work, and he said, well, how's it going being among all these other writers? I said, it's phenomenal. I mean, it's just a joy. I don't have to explain what it's like to sit in a converted walk-in closet for 60 hours a week trying to figure out how to put a sentence together. They know. I said, but the only problem is when they ask me what the book's about, it's really hard to talk about war stuff. And he said, well, it doesn't make for great cocktail conversation, And he just sort of laughed. And he said, yeah, that's kind of the deal. Again, I think for me, there's some levity to be found in there. But one of the driving impulses was when I think about the cliche war is hell, and I said, gosh, I want to make it war is hell brought home. What does it feel like at home day to day for some of these folks? And that's not to say there aren't veterans who've done exceptionally well. There aren't veterans. I've got friends who are, just didn't skip a beat. Thank goodness. But this was more for the colleagues of mine who had had a hard time. And I thought, what is it like for them to be here? Fewer than 1% of us have a direct connection to somebody who serves in the armed forces, fewer than 1% of Americans. And double check that for me. But I'm almost positive, which was astounding for me to read last year, in terms of an immediate family member, fewer than 1%. So I think that we're kind of divorced from the immediate day-to-day understanding of again, what maybe some of that is like for folks.
Well, I was looking at statistics,
I tend
to Google when I read sometimes. I was just wondering, I said, how many veterans are there? And there are about 20 million people who have been on active duty in America. So that's about 6% of the total population
6%
has served. And I'm guessing that's going to go down greatly once the Korean and Vietnamese generation pass away because of age. But that difficulty in coming back and what it presents, especially in the story Pickle, a trio of adult children of a father who is an officer in the military, and they're all suffering from terrible, debilitating sexual dysfunctions.
Yeah.
And he did as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, oh, my poor grandmother. You know, I was talking to my grandmother. I said, you probably shouldn't read this. She's 93. Her birthday's in like 2 days. I said, you probably shouldn't read these. And then I remembered that she used to sneak me into war movies and rated R movies in the 80s and the 70s. I said, wait a second. This is your fault. yeah, again, once more, I wanted to sort of the book into a young man being sort of indoctrinated into a certain type of culture and or joining the military was, again, looking at the children, potentially, of veterans. This one went to extremes. I've noticed a few times, personally, read more times, stories of how siblings often react after the death of a parent. And, you know, you see whether it's sometimes for economic reasons, sometimes it's for emotional landscape, often perhaps kindred to a sort of shell-shocky moment. People lose control of how they're going to respond. And so the basis for the story was I thought, well, what if they get in this sort of competition of dysfunction? I'm the one that this is how poorly I was treated. No. This is how what happened to me. No. Here's what happened to me. And at some point I thought of the worst on paper form of this, which for me was to be sort of physically involved with media, television, and I said, that's pretty horrible. And then I thought, but what if that's actually not the most horrible one? It spun out from there.
I don't know if I can look at the Wall Street Journal the same way.
I'm telling you, man. The one thing I will say, though, another theme of when I was trying to figure out how to write or process my own war experience, in addition to certain types of soldiers, in addition to this sort of vagueness brought home, the third thing I thought of that I hope sort of permeates this was this notion of the 24-hour news cycle, media. You know, CNN really was established as a bona fide premier news source with the onset of the Gulf War. It's not that we couldn't watch combat in the past. Certainly we've seen that. Vietnam. You can watch newsreels in the World War II. You could see the nightly news Vietnam. CNN was 24/7. And I think that really also radicalized our national concept of combat or war or going to war. Certainly with this one, it was in being embedded. So media and relationships to that culture also sort of run through some of these stories.
What was your reaction to kind of the two political ends of the spectrum trying to fight over who's the most patriotic and who loves the troops the most without actually doing anything for them?
That's a difficult one. I mean, it's interesting. I'll say that I'm of two minds. One is I'm definitely a pro-troop guy in terms of how people warrant or celebrate their relationship to that. The funny thing is, in a combat situation, that type of philosophical debate is just a frivolity. I mean, you don't sit around while somebody's potentially shooting at you or slinging a missile at you and say, well, you know, I think that I'm not against this or I'm for that. It's just because it's a waste of emotional and intellectual space, right? So it doesn't exist. I think my only frustration sometimes, and this is speaking just for me, is that I feel, given the remove that so many folks have from deployment or from even having an immediate family member, again, that was frustrating for me to say, wait a second, I wish that we were more cognizant or conscious of the potential long-term impact of a deployment before we decide that it's an appropriate time to deploy people. That was a big one for me watching those kids in 2003 and thinking, wait a second, how many of the folks who are making the call here are directly connected or have been to the military, A, and B, are they 1,000% sure that this is the right thing to do? Because even if these troops come back in 8 months, as I did, even if they spend most of these 8 months not really encountering anything but just waiting in a situation, as I did and many of my colleagues, they may well turn out like one of my dear friends from graduate school who felt the majority of the time like there was a fire underneath his skin. And he didn't know why, and he was chronically at the doctor, and he had chronic sort of substance issues, and he couldn't, you know, and I thought, that's the kind of thing that we want to make sure that we're doing right.
That was known as like Gulf War Syndrome. Yeah. And have the people that were in the most recent war, have they experienced the same thing? Or
I'm not certain that they have. I think that to the military's credit, they still are sort of slow to identify things like TBI and or to pursue diagnoses there. But I think they have been much more forthcoming about at least diagnosing or qualifying or quantifying certain types of symptoms. You know, I get a newsletter from the VA every couple of months, and it's catered to me. So I don't often get, but it does, to its credit, in the last year or two, it says Gulf War Syndrome. Here are updates. Here are things. Here's how we've dealt with this. And for years, of course, it didn't, quote unquote, exist for the majority of the time between my deployment 25 years ago. And now it wasn't even formally recognized. So I don't know. And I don't even know if they know at the VA if I can't say how far along they might be in sort of that kind of diagnostic.
Can you believe now it's been 25 years? And then when you would have been in the military, it was a shorter period back to the end of Vietnam.
It's incredible.
Than it is now.
It's incredible. It's incredible. I mean, I just a couple of days ago said, wait, quarter century. That's weird. There are people I've met. There was a young girl that I taught at some point. Oh, to her credit, she was very sweet. This is going to make her sound terrible, but it shouldn't. And this wasn't that many years ago, 6-7 years ago. And at some point, something came up. I said, yeah, I was in the Gulf War. And she said, there was a war in the Gulf of Mexico? And I said, no, darling. You know, it was this blip. Now, at the time, I think another big component about cultural memory, about our sort of cultural analysis of that experience was that, as we recall, you know, George H.W. Bush proclaimed at the end of the Vietnam era, absolute victory. Everybody came home for sure through one lens. It was, and you want that experience if you're going to deploy. But through another, again, I think there was this culture like, okay, cool, Vietnam's over. Good, we've moved past, which it's radically problematic, but also, hey, great, all we needed is another war. Everybody's fine. Let's move on. We can kind of like check this one off and move to the next one. That continuum also, again, sort of fed into some of the reasons why I want to write these stories.
And you plant some seeds of dread in for people who pay attention. I think it was in the last story, Hers, where they talk about Khobar Towers.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we know something horrible is going to happen there.
You know, I'm so glad. Good for you. Can you just read my book a bunch more times? There are all kinds of little plants there that I think a lot of folks have forgotten about. I remember hearing about Khobar Towers, and I can't remember in terms of the initial al-Qaeda bombings where chronologically it was. And again, it was so weird because it was at a remove. Where's Khobar Towers? What's Khobar Towers? Who's this group for the majority of us? And yet that's the place where, before we outprocessed and flew home, thousands and thousands of troops were there. That's the place where, before you went home, they said, hey, if you want to sign up for another 6 months or a year, you can get a decent paycheck and you'll actually work at Khobar just running the day-to-day. That's the place where you could pay $5 and have your Polaroid taken sitting atop a camel. That's the place where there was a tent that I think as coordinated or stipulated, I don't know if it was stipulated, forgive me, as part of being in that location, there was a tent where folks could go and they gave you a free copy of the Quran in case you wanted to read it. You know, it was a very interesting, almost nurturing environment to be in for many reasons. You know, whether it was R&R, whether it was ease, whether it was familiarity, these places look like condos. So yeah, it was a really trippy thing. I took it out. Initially, I had written in the site of al-Qaeda bombing this year, and I thought, no, I'm just going to pull that out, and we'll leave it, and surely someone somewhere will read it. So, serious, you may be the first and last, but I appreciate it.
Well, I pay attention. An uncle of mine did 30 in the Air Force, and then when he came out, he started to work for Lockheed, and he was like a loadmaster for C-130s, and he went and worked for the Saudi government before Gulf One started even. Wow. And so he'd lived on compounds off and on for the next like 15, 20 years. And one of the ones he had lived on was one of the ones that were attacked shortly after, yeah.
It's amazing how close it can be even if it's at remove, how quickly we sort of can tie right into something like that. Yeah, that's weird. And again, this sort of for me, even with the little bitty sentence about Khobar, war at a distance, trauma at a distance, and I wanted to kind of dive into that gap thank goodness I got off on I'll even war light in quotation marks, right? But still, it was just there. Always just a little bit at remove that rides with people sometimes.
Now, another thing that pops up not quite as often, though, is gentrification.
Yeah.
And as a resident of Nashville, you can see what that's going on right now over there.
Yeah, that's a big one for me. That's one that I'm interested in. In fact, I'm working on a novel now for Norton, which Colleen is one of the protagonists in it. I wasn't done with her story. But it also involves this notion not only of gentrification, but land ownership and how that radicalizes narrative or how it radicalizes our relationship to our cities or our privilege or our lack thereof. Yeah, Nashville's doing the thing. I've lived there off and on for 20-something years. Spaces where I first moved into that were just sort of radically neglected are now radically unaffordable. But it's not, you know, that's sort of a national campaign to some extent.
But also in the Darla stories, there's a couple of guys who flip houses.
Guys flip houses in small town Mississippi, Chicago, for sure. I go back to Chicago and I don't recognize places where I lived. I don't know about them anymore. And I was part of that. You know, I think there's also this interesting component of how does a city or even an individual navigate gentrification? How culturally, my wife and I moved back to Nashville. We had been living overseas. We've been living in Morocco for a little while and elsewhere. And we said, we want to live in the most sort of international stretch of Nashville that we can pull off. And also, our writing doesn't make you any money, so we needed an affordable place, but also we wanted to be around sort of a diverse swath of people.
And so there's a lot of Kurdish and Iraqi people over there.
Kurdish, right? Iraqi, a lot of North African folks, a lot of Latino folks. Our neighborhood's fantastic. I mean, we've got the restaurants are, you know, an Ethiopian place next to, fortunately, my favorite dive bar burger joint. But yeah, certainly a lot of Kurdish flatbread places. There's just a broad swath. And it's, for me, it's cool. The same neighborhood, there's right next door to each other is a place called House of Kebab, where people are often in full sort of gear that we associate with Islam and long beards. And they're going in. And right next door to it is Smokey's Barbecue, which, of course, serves the swine. Yeah. And so... It's a weird juxtaposition, a great juxtaposition of people looking at each other and then I'm sure going in. They don't go in and try each other's food, but it's just, that's the neighborhood. I love it. The problem is, of course, how now that neighborhood is starting to become more and more gentrified. And you're sitting there thinking, wow, I'm a part of the problem, even though I wanted to embrace something that's that. And yeah, that vexes me. And there are a lot of different ways that cities are handling it. I don't know that I read that much about cities that are handling it that well. But yeah, I can chew on that one for a while. I'm already starting another story collection, I think, that are going to potentially be just different stories from a gentrified space, different folks involved in the space. I say that now. I'm saying it here so that I'll be forced to pursue that.
Well, I do a lot of interviews with crime fiction writers. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions I ask over and over is there such a good thing as a property developer? They are always a villain in their stories.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's where we position them, but it's not going to happen. I mean, I think for me, sometimes the fright is we forget about the value of culture. We forget also if we lay a foundation or a grid over what's quote unquote valuable, we forget that a barbershop that's sort of a ramshackle space may be more valuable to the history of that town or that space or that neighborhood than anything that would go up that looks aesthetically pleasing. I like to study memory and memorial a lot in Nashville and around the South. We certainly have leaned into certain aesthetics that we have deemed, hey, this is an important space. It's pretty. It's this or that. Let's preserve it.
Studio A.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and fortunately, I think that's shifting a little bit, but yeah, I don't know. It's something I chew on a lot. I chew on it a lot. What's our identity? How long has it been here? When is it time to ditch it? When is it time to revisit it? And I link gentrification. This is certainly not fair, and all of this from a very privileged space. I mean, you know, I'm sitting here able to discuss it at length, being an active participant again, and to some degree by virtue of where I choose to live. But linking it, I think, from contemporary property development all the way to sort of memorials, statues, structures historically that we've, deemed valuable versus structures that we deem sort of a blight or invaluable. I just sort of consider this continuum to some degree.
Well, Odie, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing your collection with us.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here, and thanks for your great questions. Really appreciate it.
Odie Lindsay is the author of the short story collection, We Come to Our Senses, which is published by W.W. Norton. I'm Stephen Usury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.